I'm going on strike if that front row isn't filled. So if it's not filled, I'm on strike. We can just sit here all day. I'm going on strike if the second row isn't filled. I'm going on strike if the third row isn't filled. Joyce, you didn't want to be by yourself? You like being by yourself, don't you? Afternoon class. Is everybody tired? Let's have a couple short sessions and go home a little early. You want to?
Yes.
I knew they would want to. All right. Do you have notes?
Yes.
Great. Lynn, could you lead us in prayer, please? Do you remember a while ago, I think we were in this room over here.
Yeah.
We did a session on charisma.
Yeah.
This would be like the companion teaching to charisma. So you put both of these together. On charisma, we talked about the grace to lead. Now we're going to really focus on the character aspect, okay? So, number one, in our introduction, there's a universal leadership vacuum in our world. A vacuum. In Isaiah chapter 3, it's an interesting chapter. Come on in, dude. I don't know who it is. He's been hanging around, though. We had a little conversation earlier. Who's he belong to? Okay. Just seems to be wandering around the building. In Isaiah chapter 3, the whole passage is what happens when a nation forsakes God. And God's judgment on a nation is a lack of leadership. So when you read chapter 3 of Isaiah, you see every different level of leadership is corrupt and is, in many cases, non-existent. And there's a leadership vacuum. Nobody wants to take the lead. The English political scientist named Edmund Burke is attributed to a statement, although nobody can find where he actually said it, although everybody agrees that he said it. A famous statement related to this. He said, the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Have you ever heard that saying before? The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is good men to do nothing. Because there's a vacuum of leadership, of good quality leadership. And vacuums always get filled. Aristotle coined the famous expression, nature abhors a vacuum. It's always filled with something. And so this vacuum of leadership will be filled with ungodly leaders or with godly leadership. So we want to look at a secular versus a Christian view of leadership. And we're going to examine a pretty familiar passage and maybe one you've heard before in this context, but maybe there'll be some new insights for you. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him, that's Jesus, with her sons, and kneeling before him. She's practiced this. She knows how to do this right. She asked him for something, and he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." Now, I've pondered this, and I wonder what happened to lead up to this event. Is this something initiated by the mother? Or is this something initiated by the sons? Did they concoct a scheme? How can we get the top spots? Our mom is one of the main financial contributors to Jesus' ministry. Other parts of Scripture, we find out that Jesus' ministry was financed primarily by a number of wealthy women. And one of them, we learn, is the mother of the sons of Zebedee. So she is one of the main contributors to the ministry. Now, if you've been in ministry for any length of time, you know that people who give lots of money to the church feel, generally, a certain, entitlement. They're in a special category. Their requests should be attended to quicker than the average person, right? So we don't know all the background, but it's pretty easy knowing human nature to fill in some of the blanks. She's thinking, I'm the one making this ministry go. Obviously, fairly expensive, right? There's quite a number of people that follow along with Jesus. Obviously, these men, they have families, and so they're not gainfully employed, obviously, out of the ministry money that comes in. Their families are being provided for. So that's a lot of salaries, and it's food, it's travel money. There's a pretty serious financial investment involved, and this lady's one of the main person that's funding the ministry. So if she stops writing the checks, trouble. So maybe the two boys thought the best way to get what we want is we'll use mom. Or maybe mom, she's one of those, we call them stage moms in the States. You have that same concept, right? Putting their kids forward. Maybe she's like that and she's concocted the scheme. And they think it's a pretty good idea too. We don't know which one. A number of years ago, I was doing a small group with a number of coaches at a high school. Most of them coached on the football team. And I remember one morning I was reading this passage and talking about it. And I read this about the Zebedee's wife. And the head coach, he got this look on his face. And he blurted out. He said, I know that woman. She's been in my office many times trying to get her son to be the quarterback of the football team. If you don't know anything about American football, the quarterback is the main position, right? That everybody wants to be the quarterback. He said, I know that woman. That was hilarious. Well, not that woman, but the same basic spirit that energized these boys' mama was in this woman. Who knows? But they've got a request. Jesus answered, you do not know what you are asking. I wonder how many of our prayers Jesus would say that to us. We make this really nice, pious prayer, and Jesus is shaking his head and saying, you just have no idea what you're asking for, what it's going to take for me to give that to you. If you knew, you probably wouldn't have prayed that prayer. But they did. They asked. You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm able to drink? They said to him, I guess this is their cue, and maybe their mom's poking them. You know, this is your cue to speak. We are able. Now, this really shows us just how clueless these two boys were. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm going to drink? Yes. They have no idea what they're talking about. Completely clueless. Jesus said to them, you will drink my cup. I'm sure there were many times later throughout their life when they're experiencing the hardship, persecution, all sorts of challenges and promises in their life, they remember this statement. Jesus said, you will drink the cup that I drink. But to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to grant, but it's for those to whom has been prepared for my Father. Now, what we never get to find out in the text, and this is one of the things I'm very curious about, and I don't know if we'll have an opportunity to interview these boys or their mama when we get to heaven, but I've got several questions I want to ask. Because if you understand mindset, ancient Near East, first century, the right hand of the ruler, that is the main position. So there's a hierarchy among left or right. Left and right are the two positions, the two premier positions, but the right hand is the primary position, the left hand is secondary. Now, the two boys are there, right? I wonder if they had thought in advance, what's going to happen if Jesus grants us this request? Who gets the right? Who gets the left? You see, this is like an alliance in the Hunger Games. An alliance will help you eliminate some of the other contestants, but eventually, you're going to have to turn on one another. Eventually, these two boys, although they're in alliance together, they got this scheme, but at some point, if they get their requests, they're going to have to turn on each other. And possibly, knowing what we do about human nature, they have individually, although they haven't shared this with one another, they've thought of their battle strategy, their plan, in case they get the request, how they're going to get that premier position. That would be an interesting question to ask them, wouldn't it? Any of you curious? I'm curious about that. I wonder. And when the 10 heard, now obviously, they heard, maybe they were within range to hear, or maybe word gets out later, but somehow they find out, the 10, the others. And they were indignant at the two brothers. Now, why were they indignant? Well, what do you think? Why were they indignant? Well, obviously the text doesn't tell us, but I think we know enough about human nature. They're indignant because they didn't think of it first. They're mad because that's what they wanted for themselves. So the sons of Zebedee get a lot of blame here, but the other 10 are just as guilty. And so Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentile lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave." I'm sure that didn't go over very well. "Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." So our first thought here from the text is there is a contrast. A contrast between the secular path to leadership and the Christian path to leadership. A contrast. Jesus makes the contrast very plain. Rulers of the Gentile, they lord it over others. Kingdom leadership is servant leadership. Which leads us to point number two. The secular path to leadership requires ambition. And maybe there's probably not room in your blank there, and I thought about this later. Maybe you should insert in front of ambition selfish ambition, because the Bible makes a distinction. So let's say it this way. The secular path to leadership requires selfish ambition. The Christian path to leadership requires death to self. I've made a distinction between ambition and self-ambition. First of all, because the Scripture does. James uses the term twice, self-ambition or selfish ambition. It's used elsewhere in Philippians chapter 2. And it's important because ambition, just as a word, is a good word. The word ambition comes, it has its root in a Latin word, ambia, which means to move or movement. And so ambition is a strong desire to do something, to move ahead, to accomplish something. So ambition is good, or it can be good. Of course, it can be bad too. Ambition in itself is not sinful. Selfish ambition, obviously, is the desire to get somewhere, to accomplish something for self. But ambition in itself is godly. Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9, he says, we have as our ambition to be pleasing to Him. So ambition itself can be good, should be. The secular path, though, requires selfish ambition. I got to get ahead. It's about me. Although it's interesting, even in the secular world, they have begun to realize the potential, the effectiveness of what they call servant leadership, of course, which is a biblical concept, but it's begun to infiltrate even the secular world, primarily through a man named Robert Greenleaf, who's dead now, but he wrote a lot of books and he established a whole leadership institute, and he's been very influential in advocating this idea that leaders should get underneath their people and serve them. Now, he's doing it in a totally secular context. It's not a biblical context. As far as I know, he wasn't a believer, but he recognized and saw the power and how effective it was to lead that way, biblically. And of course, that's what we would expect, right? We would expect that God's way works better than the world's way. And sometimes the world figures that out. Next thought, number three, the secular path to leadership requires self-promotion. Self-promotion. How many worked in the corporate world or in industry or something outside of ministry for some significant time before you went into ministry? So you know what I'm talking about, right? How do you get ahead? What? Jack? Good performance. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a nice way to say it. Yeah. What, Jack?
Politics.
Politics. What does that mean?
By their votes or please.
By their votes, yeah, please their bosses.
Your, even your colleagues.
Yeah, yeah. It's like Survivor, right? Seriously, you got to figure out a way to promote yourself. And the especially good ones do it without you realizing they're promoting themselves. Some people are very overt about it, and that generally tends to turn people off. But the really good ones promote themselves, and you don't even realize that they're doing it. That's how you get ahead, self-promotion. Just the opposite of how it works in the kingdom of God. The Christian path, the leadership, requires serving. Not promoting yourself, but lifting up others. One of the great chapters in Scripture about this is 2 Kings chapter 12. It's an interesting narrative. And it's an important time in the history of the nation of Israel. Solomon has just died. And Solomon, although he started well, he went bad. Very, very bad. In maybe September of this year, we'll do a sermon series on the book of Ecclesiastes, which will be a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun working with Pastor Gilbert on that series. Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon or about Solomon, but it's Solomon in his backslidden state, which makes for a really an interesting book. It's Solomon the backslider. Solomon the man who's become a skeptic. Solomon who started with faith in God, but now has gone bad. And we read, actually, 1 Kings 11 tells us that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, one thing about wives and concubines, especially those kind, royal wives and concubines, is they cost a lot of money. to keep 1,000 wives, and most of them coming from, most of the marriages were political marriages, right? And so these are people who are used to a certain economic standard, and they expect that to be kept up. And of course, Solomon did. He not only allowed these women to continue to practice their various different pagan religions, but he actually built temples for them to practice. Now, that costs money. Where do you get that money? Class? Where do you get that money? Huh? Lena? Taxes. Yeah. Because during Solomon's reign, there are very few new territories. One way you can get is through acquisition, right? Through war, you acquire another territory, and then you take all the best from that territory or area. Most of that was done by David and is finished in Solomon's reign. So he has this burgeoning bureaucracy, this massive building project that keeps going on and on, that requires money and money. I mean, they're just bleeding cash. He needs more money, constant income. So you got to keep the taxes going up. And then he institutes what's called the corvée. It's forced labor. So it's like conscription. You know what conscription is? It's the right of a government to take young men and send them to war. It's like conscription, only not for a military purpose. So he can go to villages and just take all the able-bodied men, and they essentially become slaves of the civil government. They're forced laborers. They're forced to build all of Solomon's projects, because even though you have to pay for their food, you don't have to give them a wage. So it's cheap. And so he is essentially raping the nation of all its economic resources. I think there's probably a number of historical parallels to the Philippines in the Marcos reign. The same kind of political foment that this kind of extravagance produces, because the people obviously see these amazing projects and all this money, and they know where it's coming from. And so Solomon needs leaders for the corvée, for his forced labor, and so he finds a man of Ephraim by the name of Jeroboam, who's a highly qualified administrator, gifted leader, and he raises him up to the position of in charge of all the forced labor. But obviously Jeroboam has some kind of conscience, right? So the people, as he hears the complaints, he begins to conspire to have a revolution. Solomon gets word of it and tries to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam is able to escape to Egypt. Now Solomon dies, and his son Rehoboam comes to the throne. And so the counselors representing the tribes come to Rehoboam, and they tell him, "Your father put such a heavy tax burden on us. We need you to release us from that." And Rehoboam asks for 3 days. So he goes to the older counselors, the wise men, and he asks them, "What should I do?" And they tell him, "If you will be a servant to these people, they will serve you forever." Isn't that great advice? If you will be a servant to these people, they will serve you forever. From their heart, they will willingly give and serve. And he listens and ponders, thinks about it. Then he goes to the younger people, the ones that were in his court, right? These are people who are living off of the wealth of the court. And they give him different advice. They say, "Go tell the people, my pinky is bigger than my father's thigh." Now that's a Hebrew idiom that means, if you think it was bad under my father, wait till you see what I have planned for you. Rehoboam says, "My father disciplined you with whips. I will discipline you with scorpions." And of course, what happens? The nation rebels. And 10 of the tribes follow Jeroboam, and the nation is split, never to be reunited. all because Rehoboam didn't take this really powerful leadership advice. If you serve the people, they will be your servants forever. What a powerful leadership lesson that is for us. If we serve people, they will serve us forever. A couple other thoughts here. Let's keep going. We doing okay? Jesus set the example of serving. This is John 13. We don't have time to go through that passage, but it's quite an interesting passage. You're familiar with it. It's the beginning of the upper room discourse that starts in chapter 13 and goes through 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. So these are five chapters of Jesus talking to his disciples just before he's about to be betrayed and to go to the cross. And the text begins with an introduction. Jesus, knowing that he'd come from the Father, in other words, knowing who he is, knowing what he was about to do, the Bible says, having loved his disciples, he loved them to the end. Now, unfortunately, this is where really important information is lost in translation. Our English versions do the best they can to translate what Jesus said, or what John said about Jesus. Having loved his disciples, he loved them to the end. Now, the Greek construction there is a word, well, we won't go into what the word is, but it implies not till like the end, like the class is over, but to the uttermost, to the farthest limits. Beyond what you could do. You couldn't go any more to love. And this is important, you see, because this is the Greek construction of the words right there are the same ones that's used in John chapter 19, verse 30, when Jesus said, it's the end, or mostly translated in our Bibles as it is finished. But he said, he used the same words there used about him in John chapter 13. Having loved him, his disciples, he loved them to the uttermost. And then we see what that means. It is ended. In other words, loving them to the point, going all the way to the point of dying for them. And of course, you know what he does. He takes, disrobes, and he takes the role of a servant, and he takes the lowest role, and he washes their feet. And then he says, what I've done for you, you should do for one another. But you see, because we miss what's lost in translation from Greek to English, we think that means the example is washing the feet. You see, but that is just an indicator. The real example is to the end. It's not just washing your brothers and sisters' feet. It's the uttermost, giving your life for them. So when Jesus says, what I've done, I've given you an example, as I've done to you, you should do for others. What he's saying is, as I went to the cross and laid down my life, loved you to the uttermost, that's how you should lay down your life for one another. That's a pretty high level of serving, isn't it? That sets the bar a little bit higher than just taking the lowliest job of washing someone's feet. I mean, as disgusting it is as it is to wash someone's feet, and it is, right? Pretty much. Have you ever done that? Yeah. We used to have, in the early days in Maranatha, ooh, I used the M word in class, sorry. In the early days of Maranatha, we would have communion services along with foot washing. Yeah, so you would take communion with one another and then wash each other's feet. Let me tell you, it's gross, okay? I'm just telling you, it's gross. Especially if you don't know it's coming, you weren't prepared for it. But as disgusting as that might be, and just think right now, if we all take off our shoes and Mike had to go around and wash everybody's feet individually, you know. I mean, you know, You can, yeah, with a gun to his head. Yeah. He would do it because he's a godly man and a servant, and because we wouldn't let him live if he didn't. But I mean, you know, you'd much rather do that than to go to the cross. But that's the bar. That's the standard that Jesus set of our example. A few other thoughts about serving. We serve God when we serve others. Paul said it this way, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men. Since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward, it's the Lord Christ you are serving. Now, how many, I'm sure many of you here, have used that verse many times in the particular role that you have? Because generally, let's just talk real here, administrators in our spiritual ministry, although you're loved and respected, sometimes you get called on to go above and beyond the call of duty, right? And you do a lot of behind-the-scenes kind of activity. And unless you're continually reminding yourself, I'm doing it for Jesus. He's the one who sees me. He's the one who rewards me. It can get draining, I'm sure. So I'm sure most of you understand this idea. We're serving others. We're serving God. William Booth was the founder of the Salvation Army, and it became a worldwide movement during his life. And near the end of his life, there was a big convention. They would have an annual convention in England, and that particular year he wasn't able to attend. He would always attend and give the keynote speech, but he's older now. Travel's a lot more difficult in those days. And so instead, he agreed to send a message to them they would read at the conference. And in those days, the version of email was telegraph. Okay, and so he sent a telegraph, and everybody was excited. There was the big moment in the plenary session where this telegraph from our founder was going to be read. And so they opened the telegraph, and it was one word. And it was just simply others. Others. That's all. Just others. That was the one message he wanted to give. Others. Think about others. Serving is done with no thought of reward. Right? The bottom line, and my wife taught me this many years ago. She's been the real example in my life of serving. She always would tell me, said, it's not serving until it hurts. It's not serving until it hurts. If you like it, you're not serving. But when it hurts, that's when you're serving. And you do that without thought of reward. And God will certainly test us here, won't he? God will certainly test us here, won't he? Serving is actively looking out for the needs of others. Actively looking out, that's the operative word. And finally, serving is the path to promotion in God's kingdom. Another Salvation Army story. When William Booth was leading, and in his prime really in England, there was an American pastor, a very successful pastor, named Samuel Brengle. He had a fairly large, prosperous, successful church. He was a well-known minister, had a fairly significant ministry. And he had received an offer from another even larger church, which meant more influence, more money, just a better all-around situation. And he was contemplating that, but he was really intrigued with the ministry of the Salvation Army, General Booth, and he wanted to go to England and take a position there. But there wasn't anything available. But he decided he went anyway, and William Booth, when he met him and talked to him and interviewed him, he decided to give him the position of what they called in those days blacking boots. We would call it shoe shining. Now, the Salvation Army, if you know anything about them, it was a revival movement, but they sort of patterned themselves after an army. So they had officers, and they thought of themselves as the army of the Lord, but it's a Salvation Army. It's not an army with guns and bullets, but an army with Bibles and the love of God. A parachurch organization that across the world did a tremendous amount of good, led a lot of people to Christ. And so the officers would wear military regalia, and they would have the big black boots. Now, of course, they would be ministering all day. We're talking about mid, late 1800s in England. Most of the streets aren't paved. It rains a lot there. These boots are caked with mud at the end of the day. And so William Booth's job, and it would take him all night, it was a night job, he would spend the night cutting off all that caked mud, washing the boots down, putting the polish and blacking all the boots. And it would take him 8 to 10 hours throughout the night to get ready for the next day. And night after night, this is his job. And one night he tells a story. He was complaining. His Lord, I came all the way across the ocean. I left a great church. I left the opportunity to have an even better church, more influence. And all I'm doing here is cleaning the boots of these men. So he's going on, grumbling and complaining. And in the middle of it, the Lord shows up. You know, as he has a tendency to do in the middle of our complaints, and gave him a revelation of this passage in John 13 that we looked at, of Jesus stripping himself and washing their feet. And with tears streaming down his eyes, he said, Lord, you wash their feet, and so I will black their boots. And he took that responsibility on. And as a result of serving, he became, later on, the first American-born director, overseer of the entire Salvation Army. So he eventually ascended to the highest position that you could take after Booth had died. Because serving is the path to leadership. Now, serving isn't the path to leadership when you think this is the path to leadership. You see, when your motivation is, I want to get leadership, so this is the way to do it, that's just self-promotion. It's a little bit more sanctified in the way the world does it, but it's still self-promotion. Serving is the way to promotion, but only when it's not the way to promotion. When it's just serving the Lord Jesus. How are we doing? We okay? A little bit more? We don't have food coming in, right? Because of the short? We do? I should have known. We couldn't survive. We went to the parking party yesterday. You know, I thought, okay, it's 30 minutes, right? You know, I can endure 30 minutes in the heat. So I got there and, wow. I said, Carlos, how long is this going to last? He said, I don't know, hour and a half or so. This is just an excuse to have food, though, right? Wasn't it? I'm glad it was documented, though, that I was there, as we saw today, right? I knew that would be a way to get documented, because we left very early, after about 30 minutes. Okay, let's talk a few more minutes here before the food comes. Character is the foundation of leadership. Number one, the foundation of Christian leadership is character. Leaders maybe we should cross out may and put must, have charisma and ability, but if they do not have character, their influence will not last. Almost all of the qualifications Paul lists for leaders are related to character. This is 1 Timothy chapter 3. 2 through 7, almost all of the qualifications Paul lists for leaders are related to character. I think there's 21 or 22 characteristics. Only one is what we would call a spiritual characteristic, able to teach. But everything else is related to character. Now, this is important. Character is defined by the following statements. I did a lot of research on character, what it is, how do we define it. Character is the sum total of the principles and motives that control a person's life. Sum total of the principles and motives that control a person's life. Character really is just the summary of who you are as an individual. A couple other thoughts. Character is the actions of a person under pressure. I like that. Helen Keller, do you know who she was? Yeah. She said, character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through the experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened and success achieved. It's fairly easy to have good character, or at least to look like you have good character, when everything is going great. When everything is running smooth, the money's coming in, the kids are behaving, your husband is just doing everything you want him to do, everything is going smooth. Man, you just got so much character. You just like right next to God. Pastor Kevin York calls it God Junior. You're just like right there. But you really find out, don't you, when things fall apart. When the pressure comes, that's when what's in here really comes out. I had a wonderful opportunity to practice this today. We are preparing on Friday morning. We leave for the States, and my wife usually, she's a last minute packer, you know, and it takes her, you know, because she's been here for almost 3 months, you know, and so it's not like just a short little trip. There's a lot to think about. I can pack in about 30 minutes, you know, so the night before it's no big deal. She generally ends up spending, she doesn't estimate her time very well generally, and so she thinks she has more time than she does. She usually, the night before we leave and we take the early flight, she usually is up till 2 or 3 in the morning, and we got to get up around 3:30. So, but this time, 3 days ago, actually, she was packed, fully packed and ready to go. I made a little post on Facebook, said obviously this grandma is very excited to get home and see her little grandbabies. I was shocked. I mean, all those suitcases are beautifully stacked in the corner. She just, just ready to go. And you know, you got to psych yourself up because it's painful. From the time we leave our condo, the time we open our door in Nashville, it's about 26 to 28 hours. That's from traffic, you know, cabs to Manila Airport, going through 17 different lines in Manila Airport, going to Nagoya, layover, Detroit, layover, customs, Nashville, traffic, drive home. And it really reveals. Like, I can look godly here in class. To fool most people, nobody who traveled with me would be fooled. You know, I'm tall, and I'm really claustrophobic. So I get on those planes. The flight across will come in, it's 13 and a half hours, the big one from Detroit to Narita in a plane, you know. And I can't sleep very well because, you know, the seats are tiny, right? And I'm just a nervous wreck, you know. And so I worked real hard to find the perfect seat. Okay, of course, the perfect seat is up in the front. I don't get to go up there. But the perfect seat in the back part where the cattle go, you know, that's me and most everybody else. Looking for the perfect seat. And on the Delta 747-400s, it's seat 35B and C. Okay? Trust me on this. It's 35B and C. or the companion on the other side of the aisle, right? But B and C is better because you get off, you beat more people off, okay? So, but those are the best seats, right? And I have gold status, so I get my flights early, and I get those seats. Not everybody can get those seats. I get them reserved, and I check them regularly because there's nothing in front of you. I mean, I can stretch my legs all the way out, and there's nothing over the top of me, you see, because when I just feel like the world is crashing in on me. But I can stand all the way to the top and read. So I spend a lot of time standing up. That's the only way I can survive. And I checked today because I thought, well, let's see if I can print anything or boarding passes. And they had moved me. Yeah, feel my pain. One row back, not Alita, who's not even gold. She's just silver. They kept her. They moved me back. And you see, the good thing about B and C is it's only two seats. Everything else on the side are three. That's the two. Me and my wife, no other people crowding me around. Because I sit on the B side, and it's this far to the window. So I just, I can breathe. They moved me right behind with everything closing in on me. On the window. And I'm starting to panic. This is my opportunity, you see. Character is the actions of a person under pressure. So I'm starting to hyperventilate. This is early. This is about 4 o'clock in the morning when I have my breakfast and I just checked and I see this. Okay, it's okay. Get all your details in a row. I had proof that I had that seat. I've had that seat confirmed since back in December. Got all the documentation ready. You know, I'm ready. But I'm just praying in the Spirit. Lord, I just want to be a godly example. I trust you. You're sovereign. Not a sparrow can fall to the ground without you knowing it. You work all things after the counsel of your will. I'm getting all psyched up, right? Because I don't want to lose my temper on the telephone. Because that's what I feel like. I want to hurt somebody. I've had nothing but great experience with Delta. So I'm fairly confident this is all going to get worked out. And maybe if I work it right, we might get an upgrade. So, 45 minutes later, I do not have an upgrade. I do not have my seat. I talked to that person and her supervisor. And I actually said, let me talk to your supervisor. She said, my supervisor doesn't talk on the phone. I'm as high as you can go on the phone. And they were not budging. She said, sir, there's someone in that seat now. I can't move them out. I said, but somebody moved me out to put that person. Who is that somebody? And let's get that somebody to put me back. If you can't move, let them do it. Character is the actions of a person under pressure, you see? The real you comes out in pressure situations like that. I will testify that up until the last moment, I had fairly good Christian character. The last moment, though, I was doing pretty good. She didn't satisfy. My wife and I are not sitting together now on the flight. But then after, you know, we're done, and she says, is there anything else I can help you with? Man, that was like the last straw. Do you know that expression? The straw that broke the camel's back? You know what that means? It's like, it's just a little thing, but on top of everything else, bam. That was the last one. I was so good up to then. I didn't say anything, but I just hung up the phone. So that was anger. That was not godly. But pressure reveals what we really are, right? Now, you experience that almost every day probably in your life, don't you? I mean, the jobs you do, there's a lot of pressure. We always want it when? Yesterday. pressure. What happens when you get under pressure? What really comes out? That's what's really you. Now, we like to say, you just have to forgive me for the other day. I just wasn't myself. No, that's actually who you really are. What you weren't is what you want us to think you are. You see, that's the difference between reputation and character. We find out what we are in those situations. At which leads us to the next point. Character is who you are. Reputation is who people think you are, or who you want them to think you are.